Group meeting, Friday, 10th February, 1984. You may all remember that for the last 5 or 6 years, we have been trying to understand something about the context of transcendence. As you all know, I use the word transcendence rather than the word God, because all these words, such as God, Brahman, and so on, they are so heavily loaded now by use partly, and very considerably by misuse throughout the centuries. So it is better to use another word which is not heavily loaded, so that we, if we are really earnest about it, can direct our efforts towards understanding the reality, the ultimate reality, the truth, which is represented by these words, by these names of the Supreme Being or the Ultimate or whatever you like to call it. Now, the context of transcendence is the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. Whereas our context is the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. Now we can, because we talk about these things, we are compelled to talk in terms of two contexts: the worldly context, the perishable context, which is the finite, temporal, and the mortal, and the postulated imperishable context of transcendence, which is the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. We are compelled to do that because we cannot talk together otherwise. In actuality, there is only one total reality, the one context which subsumes our everyday context. Now, it is not easy to sort of become conscious of this. We may see it as an idea, a thought, we can muse on it, we can argue about it, we can discuss it, and so forth. But all that is quite useless. What is really required is that we become clearly conscious of the context of transcendence, which is the infinite, eternal, and the immortal. So being conscious is something very different from ideas, convictions, conceptions, and all the rest of it. This is where the great difficulty lies all along. We human beings are constituted as we are. We say, know this, that, or the other through the use of our sense functions and through logical, intellectual processes by the brain, which uses the instrument of language to record all this and to convey all this. But all that belongs to the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. It's so difficult to escape it. I shouldn't say escape it. What we need to do is not to escape from it, but to be able so to live that we can become conscious, even in the slightest possible measure, we can become conscious of the transcendent context. And that is what happens with the great mystics, the great spiritual teachers, and so forth. They get that extraordinary change in their whole consciousness, which enables them to experience the reality of the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. Now, you may remember that we have been talking about, I shouldn't say so much talking, we have been considering how transcendence, the origin, the absolute origin, as the starting point, holds within itself all that emerges into manifestation, holds within itself all that in potentiality. And in the expression and development of that potentiality, the whole of space, time, matter, the laws of nature, and so forth, come into being. Now, we can talk about it in our little limited, finite way. And as you know, throughout the centuries, tomes and tomes have been produced presenting the what are considered the profound truths of religion and so forth. But all those tomes have never sufficiently seen and therefore never properly emphasized or pointed out the importance of becoming conscious of the transcendent. These are all ideas, statements about God and the universe and man and his destiny and all the rest of it. Are they true? Do they really correspond to what actually happens in the process of the involution of this primordial, undifferentiated creative energy which becomes the whole universe? Have they really experienced that? Now I say that the truly great spiritual teachers of the world through the last 50-60 centuries approximately have experienced that. That extraordinary transformation of consciousness has taken place in their being, and it is from that depth of consciousness of the actuality of the eternal truth, as we may say, that they have tried to indicate to human beings how they should live in order that this fruition may take place. This is one of the great purposes of our existence in the world. Now, you know, I have often used the phrase the one total reality. And we may say that all nature, the whole of nature, the whole of the manifested universe, including man, has an inborn sense of transcendence, an innate sense of the absolute, of God, of the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade, etc., etc. Use any sort of words you like to suggest the transcendence. And as you know, in all the religions of the world, including those which are supposed to be non-theistic, you see, in all the religions of the world, there has been an unquestionable awareness of transcendence, a real living, functioning, active awareness of transcendence in the great teachers. Now, I would add to that that this sense of transcendence is inherent in every single thing, from an atom to a galaxy, from a virus to the perfected Holy One. Everything and everyone has this inherent sense which may or may not come to fruition during the lifetime of that object or that creature. And if we are concerned with human fulfillment, human fruition, then we should see in what way we should live. And we must discover that for ourselves. It's not for me or anybody else to lay down what you should do or how you should do things. We should try and find out for ourselves how we should live in order that this fruition may take place. Now remember, the most important aspect of the effort which we direct, which we put in this direction, the effort must be free of all selfness. One mustn't make the effort in order that I or you or so and so may realize fruition. You and I and so will never realize fruition during one's lifetime. Because you see, when we put it that way, there is the implication of an end point, the ultimate goal. Where the living universe is concerned, there is no such thing as an ultimate goal. There is always development, always a growing and a growing and a growing taking place. And whatsoever fails to grow and grow towards its proper fulfillment, then that will just die rather uselessly. Few people ever realize their humanity. The bulk of human beings, from the time that the hominids came on the scene, something like what, 25, 27 million years ago, they began to come on the scene then. From that time, the bulk of them have just died like autumn leaves falling to the ground. Now, autumn leaves fall to the ground very usefully. They fertilize the soil. What have the thousands of millions, the billions and billions of creatures who have been on the globe since so many million years ago, you see, what have they contributed towards human development? Neither they know about it, nor can we estimate what they contributed. Provided they lived in some measure or other, in the manner in which they fulfilled their particular place, in their particular little way, in their particular circumstance, there was fulfillment. Now, we human beings today, how many thousands and thousands of us feel, oh, what is the purpose of my existence? I'm useless, I can't do a thing, I'm a mistake. And yes, all right, yes, you are a mistake, my dear fellow. True enough. But once you recognize that you are a mistake, you cease being a mistake. The recognition, the cognizance, the diagnosing of the disease is the first and proper step towards the healing of the situation. You see? So, we must be free from all selfness, that we want some fruition for ourselves, or for our society, our family, our nation, or anything. It's a profound error. And it's an excuse which has been very hurtful in human history, because that person misuses what abilities he has for self-aggrandizement usually. We have to realize that it is transcendence itself which is fulfilling itself through us. Transcendence fulfills itself in perfection through the lovely flower, through the cloud, through the earth, through the mosquito, through the beast of prey, through you and me and everybody that there is in the world. There is a difference. The mosquito, or the ant, or whatever it is, or even the dear old elephant, they cannot be personally aware. they can't be conscious of the direction in which the life of the world is moving. They cannot be. You and I can. Whereas the mosquito or the rose or the oak cannot consciously cooperate with transcendence, you and I can. That is what we can do. And it's precious little, isn't it? What we do. However, we must bear that in mind very carefully. Otherwise, we will fool ourselves that we are directing our efforts for right living in the right way. We are not directing. There's always this subtle selfness involved. It's so subtle. It's the last thing which disappears before real enlightenment dawns upon the person. It's the last thing that disappears. Now, consider how man starts being aware of himself and his life. The infant grows up and becomes aware of the body as myself. It names the mother, the father, the brother or sister or friend or whoever it is, it names them, and it only names the body. The body is the whole thing for the infant. There is no escape from that. That's the natural process. You can't avoid it. And then, as he grows up and becomes aware of the functions of the body, he becomes conscious in all these separate ways. He sees that his functioning is in separate terms. There is one functioning which is walking, another which is running, another which is playing, another which is eating. And then when he grows a little bit older, he comes to know about digesting, assimilating, eliminating. He comes to know all that, you see. And then thinking, talking, procreating, using his senses. By the time he's an adolescent, all these things become very vivid in his consciousness. But everything is vivid in terms of separateness and in terms of isolativeness. I am I, not this, that or the other. He doesn't know that the actual fact is that the total universe is me, and I am the total universe by virtue of relationship of the manifested objects and persons. The interrelationship of the entire universe is complete and total. Modern science, too, is discovering that very strongly in the sphere of its investigations of the nature and the properties of matter, what we call matter, you see. But in terms of human relationships and that which belongs to the psyche and to the spirit as such, very few people are awakening up to that. This is what we have to see to and do it. We have to start with ourselves. One has to start here, now. You can't start there and at another time. You have to start with yourself all the time. You know the Greek nothi se auton, know thyself. And in the Rig, and as far back as in the Rig Veda, which is the oldest religious treaties we have in the world, you know, for all the Indo-European peoples. And that means practically for the whole world, because they didn't have writing before that. See, in the Rig Veda you have Atmanam Atmana Pashya. To see the self, oneself, the little self, by means of the total self. Now you see, the whole story of man's evolution, development, fulfilling the purpose of his existence and so on, is all involved in that single sentence. Atmanam Atmana Pashya. To see the Supreme Self, the total self, by means of the little self and vice versa. To see the little self by means of the total self. Now see, it's, I'm afraid I must admit I am adding this reverse way in addition. You see, for this reason, one normally tries to understand the particular thing, the little thing, in terms of the little things around. That tells us the qualities, the properties of the particular thing up to a point. But if you want to know the whole of that little thing, you have to start with the transcendent whole. That's where Krishnamurti said something which I doubt if anybody really understood. If you want to realize the truth, start from the other shore. See? And at the same time, the fact remains, you can't start from the other shore. But there is a way of making the other shore come towards you. Now let me leave out other shore and use the word transcendence. Since transcendence is the totality, is everything altogether, whatsoever I may do produces a response out of the totality. What I, the little thing, the little person can do is very little, of course. But the response from the totality is tremendous, always. We think, oh, what can a uneducated, little ignorant person like me do? It's true that I can do very, very little. But I'm not calculating I'm not able to calculate the tremendous response out of the totality. It's a little bit like this. You know, a river starts high up in the mountains and the water flows downwards, finding the way of least resistance. As it flows down, it meets with some big boulder, you see, which makes it move to the right or the left, as the case may be, you see, and it goes down. And this thing happens over and over again, doesn't it? But what is the consequence to the people who may be living on this side of that boulder or that side of that boulder? The one lot will get water which they can use for watering their fields and so forth, and the other lot may not have it, and therefore they'd be under considerable difficulties. It's a little bit like that. You and I, or at least I am, only a very little pebble in the universal, in the universe, a very small pebble. But I can never say whether my action will mean the waters of life quenching the spiritual thirst of thousands of people, or leaving thousands of people on the other side who are unsupplied with the water. It's like that. So we have to be very careful not to depreciate the tiniest little effort which we may make. And here, of course, the words of Sri Krishna are extremely wise. Whatsoever thou doest, do it as unto me, unto the Supreme. Don't be concerned about the consequences. Of course, whatsoever thou doest does not mean shooting rockets at school children and so forth, you see. It doesn't mean that, obviously. Do it as unto me. And the fact remains that it is transcendence which reaps. We can do the sowing, a very tiny little sowing, but it is transcendence that really reaps the whole. You know that during the months since the autumn, since September particularly, we have been trying to free ourselves from all sorts of misconceptions about things, which have the sanction of conventional orthodox religion behind them. One of the very important things was in connection with heaven and hell. And you know, particularly the theistic religions, all of them, they have said, unto the evildoer there will be a permanent hell, an eternal hell, and unto the good doer an eternal heaven. I challenge the statement. I say it's entirely wrong. It's absolutely false. How can I, a little mortal, with small capacity or ability, living in terms of the finite and the temporal, do anything which can possibly produce an infinite eternal consequence? It's utter nonsense. Now you see, we must be fair about this. Zarathustra started all this. He was the first of the great spiritual teachers, before Moses too, probably. This is still a probability. We don't quite know the date. But Zarathustra's date, people now put at about 1500 BC. You see? Now, he said, and he said that because this is how God, Ahura Mazda is the Zarathustrian name, that God had conveyed to him that evil comes to the evil doer, good comes to the good doer. And there was one particular instance in what he said, where he said, for all time. Well, of course, that for all time is interpreted in terms of eternity. Now you see, it's no good talking about a compassionate, all-merciful, all-compassionate and wonderful God and talking about an eternity of heaven. It's no good talking about an omniscient and a just God and talking about an eternity of heaven for the good doer. How can I do anything which deserves an eternity as its consequence? Quite impossible. So we must be free of all that stuff and nonsense. The justice of life is not in terms of reward and punishment. The justice of transcendence is in terms of healing, in terms of making whole, making holy. Now, Zarathustra did teach that also, very definitely. you see. And the other religions also have that element in them. But they haven't put it in sensible terms. Look at St. Paul, for instance. Is it in Corinthians or somewhere there? Be not deceived, God is not mocked. Whatsoever ye do, that shall ye also reap. Am I the sole agent of whatsoever I do in life? How many influences have been at play? The people around me, the circumstances, the teachings, the education, the upbringing, all this has come into play. And my own thinking, which is partly stupid and partly sensible, you see. All these influences have come into play to produce any act of mine. And do I reap the consequences? Supposing my father were a very successful businessman and he made an immense fortune and said, when I retire, I shall then be able to enjoy life. The day after he retired, he died. And who reaps? I get all that. You see, all these teachings have been put in such absurd and ridiculous forms. People haven't tried to understand and to critically examine all the religious teachings. Look at the belief in the founder of a religion being omniscient. He is omniscient particularly in one respect. How man may live so that he can be completely purified and transcendence can realize perfect humanity through that particular man. In that way they are omniscient, but they are quite ignorant about all the other matters of ordinary everyday life and about the universal process and everything. They are quite ignorant about such things. They couldn't know simply because these things are being known and investigated now in our own day and age. So one mustn't have the wrong kind of faith in the teacher. You know, I always tell you, don't believe a word of what I say. But you're so naughty that you're inclined to believe. I only say, consider the thing. What I say may be right, or it may not be right. It may need revision. It may need correction somewhere. You see? Now, if we have the spirit of right inquiry, not starting off with a preconception, oh no, that's all nonsense, oh yes, this is it, you will find that all those attitudes are the result of a backward mind, a dull mind. Consider very carefully and keep awake all the time. In your sleep too, keep awake. You've never experienced that, have you? But it is possible to be awake in your sleep. The Upanishads put that very clearly, and of course people have hopelessly misunderstood the meaning of it. We won't go into it now because we must go on with what we have started with today. Well, as far as I am concerned, heaven and hell are completely out. Heaven and hell is what I make here and now by my own thinking and feeling, by my own words, and by my own actions. That is all. That is what brings heaven and hell to me here and to my little environment. There is no other heaven and hell in a mythical hereafter. Then consider this sort of statement, that again, it is derived fundamentally from Zarathustra's own teachings, because he was the first of the great teachers. The body, the living psychophysical organism, can do right or wrong, but the soul, which is immortal, receives the reward in heaven or the punishment in hell. Now, if there is a thing called the soul which is immortal, it belongs to the context of the infinite, obviously, and the eternal. And that is, the eternal really means the immortal. You see? All right. Now, how many people are ever conscious of their souls? Assuming that such a thing like the soul exists. Who is conscious of the soul? A person's whole life process is controlled from his brain and from his particular self-conception and his thoughts and conceptions about his environment. This mysterious thing called the soul, it's not there. So great a philosopher as Aristotle said very clearly, it is in his De Anima, in his treatise, De Anima, he said that the soul is one of the most difficult things to understand at all. And throughout centuries, all sorts of ideas have been put out with regard to the soul, you see. But is that the reality? Now, we can look at it this way. What we call the soul or the spirit, etc., etc., you see, all that is an expression of the evolutionary process which has taken place out of the activity of the primordial creative energy. I postulate a primordial creative energy because something has to be postulated. And what people have done through the ages is to postulate a being called God, who is this, that, and the other, and say that God did this and God did the other. Let us keep a completely open mind. It happened that way. But there was an origin, obviously. A source. And that origin transcended time and space. Time and space came into being with the Big Bang. Not till then. So, if the origin created a soul each time a child was born, and the child throughout his life never knew what his soul was, how can you reward or punish that soul for what this fellow did in his lifetime? Perfectly ridiculous, isn't it? Consider it. Am I right? Am I wrong in the matter? Now look at it another way. If the soul is immortal, it belongs to the context of the infinite and the eternal, and it is the same context as the context of the origin, the context of transcendence itself. Let us use the word God if you like. So, God punishes a tiny bit of God forever and ever, chucks him into hell, and God rewards some potty little fellow who has done one or two good things which overbalance all his bad things, you see, in a permanent heaven. How perfectly ridiculous again. You see, it's important to consider these things, because by such consideration we can be open-minded. the mind can be clean. Clean because all the stupid muck which clutters up the mind with all these ideas and beliefs and conceptions and so forth, when that is out, the light of transcendence will shine. You'll experience it. I assure you, you will experience it. And you see, another thing, Zarathustra declared that God, the Supreme, created two spirits, one the good spirit, another the bad spirit. And those who follow the bad spirit, they'll get it in the neck. Those who follow the good spirit will be up here in heaven with me. And what sort of a heaven? Zarathustra didn't teach that. Well, what sort of a heaven it was? It was the later scriptures. You see, the scriptures, the Zarathustrian scriptures, have a lifespan of 1500 plus 900, 2400 years. The 9th century AD, from 15th century BC to the 9th century AD. And the people who came afterwards produced all this nonsense. All that Zarathustra taught exists in just 234 verses. That is all. So you see, we have to realize the importance of complete open-mindedness. If we have that open-mindedness, then truth will make itself known to us. It will come upon us. And that truth which comes upon us will be something which defies conceptualizing and verbalizing. But that truth coming upon us means that oneself has fulfilled the purpose of his existence. He won't know it. Because you see, the person who has become selfless, truly selfless, doesn't know what's happening to the self. Look at a rosebud and see how it holds the perfection and beauty of the full-fledged rose. And when it opens out and gives forth its perfume with no thought of I must please the gardener or anything like that, just utterly selflessly, it blossoms out. This is how we have to blossom out. Let it happen. And you know, you will realize a peace and a freedom which utterly defeats anything that worldly considerations may offer you. You can plan out peace if you like. People have been doing that for thousands of years, for millions of years in fact. But is there peace? Has there ever been a real peace in the world? But this peace comes if you just let transcendence itself work through you.